Boker Tov. So yeah, it is Boker Tov. Depending, it's good morning, but Erev Tov or Tzaraim Tov. I'm in Israel. I want to welcome everybody. Nice to see everybody, and to welcome for her initial talk on Torah Motion Zoom channel, Dr. Olga Kirschbaum Shirasky. Who, if I'm sorry if I mispronounced the last name. The second, Dr. Olga, as you've heard, we're discussing, grew up in Toronto. Something I did not know until after we arranged her talk. I had no idea she grew up in Toronto. Obviously, we didn't know each other growing up. She's a little younger than I am. She went, as you heard, to York University and University of Toronto, and then got a PhD in modern European history from NYU. She now lives in Tel Aviv, and where she's the editor of the Tel Aviv Review of Books, an online review presents the entire spectrum of views about Israeli culture, religion, and politics to an international audience. And it's a pleasure to welcome her to Torah in Motion, and we look forward to this class. I think of at this time of year, Noahite laws and sort of the relationship between the Jewish and the non-Jewish world, I think is an important topic in general, and I guess especially at this time of year. So, Dr. Olga, bakasha.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. I'm pleased to see all your faces. Can you hear me all right? The audio is okay? Good. So just to link up to the issue of this time of year, they say that there are 3 months that are under the mazal of Esav and not under the mazal of Yisrael. And that's the month of Tevet, the month of Av, and the month right before Av. So we have three months that are not under this mazal. And Tevet, as you know, has the fast, and one of the aspects of the fast is the translation of the Torah into Greek. So it's kind of there's a connection particularly to Esav and to, and why is that relevant to the Noahide laws? Because in a way, in the modern period, if we think of Esav as an archetype and we think of it as an archetype of the Western world, which is how the rabbis have viewed Esav as the archetype of Rome and through Rome, Christianity and the West has held the banner of universalism in all kinds of different ways, right? Through Christianity, through in the Enlightenment, the idea of universal law or universal rights. So what I'm going to do with you today is kind of walk you through the Noahide laws through time, if you will, and starting sort of from the original text. And it's going to be an overview. It's not Be'iyun, it's Be'kiyus that we're going to be doing in this talk. So we're going to do an overview coming to sort of have a bird's eye view of this question of Noahide laws in the Jewish community and in the community of nations from antiquity to the present. So I am looking at everyone's faces, and I imagine that you have, many of you already have a good understanding of Jewish sources. So I'm going to go through things fairly quickly, and if you have questions, please feel free to type them in on the side, or if things are redundant for you, and I'll just move on to something else. So the Noahide laws are recorded in the Talmud and then the Tosefta. And the recording of the Noahide laws says that they were given to Adam. And so the first, if you will, debate in these sources is as to how many laws of these seven, which I will enumerate, were given to Adam, and how many, and what was given thereafter to Noah. So the laws are, I think, if you are familiar with them, and they are presented in different order in a couple of different sources, but not to worship idols, not to curse God or to blaspheme, not to commit murder, not to commit adultery or sexual immorality, not to steal, not to eat the flesh of a living animal, and to establish a court system of justice. So the idea was for what the rabbis expounded on in the Talmud is that there was a text within the Bible that referenced these Noahide laws, and it was the remes or the hint that Adam had received these laws and that they were repeated again to Noah. So an important point for everyone here is that the Noahide laws exist in the Talmudic sources as an oral tradition that they were given to Adam and known by humanity, but they are not written in the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. So this is important later on in that the Christians do not have, through their readings of Tanakh, a tradition of the Noahide laws, or of knowing of the Noahide laws. They have a tradition of knowing. The Christians, or anyone else who has read the Tanakh, knows about the story of Noah, knows about the references to the covenant that God makes with Noah, and Noah being the progenitor of the rest of humanity, and knows also about the law in relation to murder that God gives to Noah, and the law about not eating from a living animal, but doesn't know about this system called the Noahide laws. But the Talmud, on the other hand, insists or proclaims that this, if it's not recorded in the written Torah, it is still known by humanity through the oral tradition. That this is the view. So then there's another question that comes up in the Talmudic sources as to whether the Noahide laws are still incumbent upon humanity, right? And that is a discussion that it's a big discussion. It's an interesting one. And I will get into what the poskim say about that shortly in a moment. So here we have this is the main source. So what is then afterwards? So this is predominantly something that Jews know, and that humanity is supposed to know, but for all intents and purposes may or may not have forgotten. Right. This is how the rabbis, even the earliest rabbis in the Mishnah and the Gemara, understand the Noahide laws. So the initial discussion about the Noahide laws, whether it's in the Gemara or whether it's in the Rishonim or in the Achronim, is a discussion about what is the scope of the Noahide laws. Right. So understanding them halachically in the same way that the rabbis tried to understand any other aspect of the Torah. Right. How do we understand the Torah properly, and how is it applied, and where is it applied? So the first questions that arise, and then also it's applied, the Noahide questions about halachas of the Noahide laws themselves, and then their applications for relationships between the Jews and the nations. So there's a number of thinkers among the Rishonim who discuss the Noahide laws, and probably most of you are familiar with the fact that the Rambam discusses them in his Laws of Kings, and other figures that are frequently or commonly known who discuss them are the Tosafot, right? And so Rambam is really interested in understanding a couple of questions. Number one, are the Noahide laws still incumbent on all the Gentiles? Right. And are they incumbent upon them, even if they claim not to know them? Right. Is this something that so this is it first is establishing their halachic obligation in relation to the Noahide laws. Then the second question that the Rambam is interested in, and other commentators will be also, is to what degree do the Jews have a halachic obligation to teach and to enforce the Noahide laws? So these, again, are the inner rabbinic discussions about halacha, in the same way that the rabbis would discuss the application of whether it's the laws of kashrut or it's the laws of lending, money lending, or the laws of damages, right? How do we understand the halacha of this question of the Noahide laws? And there we have a number of different positions. And then finally, there's another question which relates to various prohibitions with regards to idolaters. So Jews may not do, there are certain things that Jews may not do with idolaters. One of them that was very relevant is the question of selling goods to idolaters that will then be used for idolatrous practice. Another question was the issue of being in a business relationship with idolaters, right? Because this might lead one to go to court. And if one goes to court, then one might have to swear. And if you swear, then you may swear upon an idol, right? So the halachic, there were halachic questions in relation to doing business, which is no small matter, because these are people's livelihoods, especially in exile. Once commerce unnecessarily had to deal with people of the nations, and one might find oneself very easily in a court with the nations, and why not have a partner who is of the nations? This might ease matters in terms of business over Shabbat and the rest of it. So I cannot give a full overview of the halachic discussions of these points. I'm giving you now what are the major halachic questions that the rabbis are interested in when they're dealing with the Noahide laws. So I'm going to give you kind of a quick taste or a quick overview of the main, what they call machlokot. There's one other, and before, and then I'll give you, well, let's stick with this for a moment. So the Rambam is of the opinion that the Noahide laws are still incumbent on everyone, on all the Gentiles, even if they don't know them. And he is also of the opinion that the Jews have an obligation to teach the Noahide laws and to enforce them. This his view that the Noahide laws are all incumbent is the majority view among the medieval Rishonim and even in the Achronim, but his view that the Jews have an obligation to teach the Noahide laws becomes a minority view. It is not the accepted view. There's also the halachic question of if you know that a Noahide is going to there's teaching them generally the Noahide laws, but if you know a Noahide is going to transgress a Noahide law, or if you are going to cause a Noahide to transgress a law, do you have a halachic obligation to do anything? So here again, the majority view among the Rishonim and the Achronim is that you should refrain from enabling or making a Noahide transgress a law of the seven laws of Noah, but you do not have necessarily an obligation to stop them from transgressing one of the laws of Noah. Although all of the rabbinic commentators are in agreement that it would be a good thing for the nations of the world to follow the seven Noahide laws. So this does not so the seven Noahide laws among most of the medieval scholars remain an ideal for the nations, and in fact they remain a set of mitzvot that continue to be in force, but the Jews' role in teaching them is attenuated and muted among most of these scholars. These are the halachic questions that interest the medieval scholars. There are also a few other halachic questions that come in the Middle Ages, because the Rambam and many of the Tosafot are dealing at a time of what we could call early interreligious encounter. Right? The Rambam himself read Arabic. He was in contact with Muslims. And so one of the questions that came up also, and this is a question that comes up with the Tosafot, is how do we understand Christians and Muslims? And this is, of course, the practical question with relation to the halachic question about business that I discussed earlier, which is that if the Christians are not following the Noahide laws or they are idolaters, then we have a problem with relation to doing business with them, or if they should take us to a court, right? So the Tosafot answer this question by saying that the Christians, in fact, do believe in one God, but they add to that one God in the form of what the Christians call the Trinity, a partner, right? From shituf, what the in Hebrew shutaf is a partner, a business partner, and shituf is the concept that the Tosafot come up for this. And so they say that it is an imperfect monotheism from a Jewish perspective, but it is a permitted addition for the Noahide. This is the compromise, or this is the viewpoint of the Tosafot, and this will remain an important perspective for later commentators. And there will be among later commentators a debate as to whether this perspective, shituf, has a kind of firm philosophical foundation, or whether it's sort of an ad hoc legal legalese to get around what was a serious business problem for Jews, but that does not really have a weight philosophically. And there are serious thinkers and serious rabbis on both sides of that equation in thinking about the concept of shituf. So those are the ways that the Noahide laws come up. Related to the Noahide laws in the rabbinic literature, and this gets us more into philosophical questions, is how the Noahide laws come up in Parshanut, in discussing sections in the Torah. And also how they come up in understanding, if you will, Jewish philosophy. So I'm going to give you two important examples about this that come up. One of them is the story of Dina. So the story of Dina, results, I think many of you know it. If you've been to the Beit Knesset in the last couple of months, we read about it. And Shimon and Levi take revenge on the kidnapping and rape of their sister Dina by murdering the entire city, right? Or killing, whatever. And I'm not sure what the Lashon is in the text in Hebrew. I can look at it. But So here we have a situation, and afterwards, when we read even more recently the brachot that Yaakov gives to his sons, and in the brachot and the blessings, he seems to be somewhat critical of this you know, rather what seems at least on the plain reading of the text seems to be a very drastic measure for what is undoubtedly not, you know, not a good thing, but you know, why the collective punishment? So we have two major commentators, again, Rishonim from the Middle Ages, who deal with this question through the lens of the Noahide laws. We have the Ramban and the Rambam, both of them, and I always forget which one comes first. I believe the Rambam, predates the Ramban. And the Rambam says that Shimon and Levi's killing of all the inhabitants of Shechem were permissible based on the seventh law of the Noahide laws called the law of Dinim. So what is his logic? His logic is as follows. He holds that the Torah states that the Noahide laws are incumbent on all of humanity forever. They remain valid, and they were certainly valid at that time. And one of the Noahide laws is that all societies have to establish a court system, and they have to judge those who transgress the other laws. And here we have someone in that society, in Shechem, who transgressed the other laws through kidnapping and rape, which are both capital offenses in the Noahide laws. And he was not brought to trial. He was not, meaning that the society allowed for this crime to go not only unpunished, but unchecked, if you will. There was no, and so according to that, what the citizens of Shechem were liable for capital punishment for not having created a justice system. That is the position of the Rambam. Now, if for the modern listener, capital punishment is always very jarring. Okay, so let's put capital punishment aside for the moment. What the Rambam is basically saying is a good society requires a court system. And if that society doesn't, you know, it doesn't establish a court system, there's something very wrong and very corrupt, and they are liable criminally, if we want to put it in kind of contemporary legalese. So that is his position. The Ramban also talks about the Noahide laws, but he discusses it in a somewhat differently. He says as follows. He says that, in fact, Shechem was a place that was corrupt, and the citizens were individually and collectively responsible for transgressing multiple of the Noahide laws. So they weren't, and so Shimon and Levi were in fact simply judging them and then meeting out the appropriate punishment for all of their crimes, not specifically the crime of not having established a court system to judge Dina's kidnapper. So we have, what's interesting about that is that they are not, and this is an important point, it's a point that also relates to the Canaanites, is that there is no murder out of, or if you will, out of a kind of racial is not the right term, but the punishment here isn't some kind of like intergroup violence. Right. The punishment is understood by the rabbis as relating to the ethical behavior of the nations. And the same thing is true, by the way, when we get to Yoshua's conquest of Canaan, or even when we heard this earlier in the Parshiot of previous weeks, that Abraham he's exiled the family. He's told that the family will be exiled to Egypt because the sin of the Canaanites is not complete, meaning that their exile And in fact the mitzvah of conquering and killing the Canaanite nations is in fact a punishment, right, of chayav mita, of capital punishment for their sins. That there's a certain time period that God gives a society to continue sinning before time is up. And this is true. This is a kind of, if you will, collective logic that is true both in Tanakh, both for the for the Jews and for the nations. And it is, and so the rabbinic thinkers are then saying, well, you know, we know the Jews are in terms of this collective punishment. The prophets say, well, you Jews have not followed X, Y, Z mitzvah, and you have not done this. And so here we see among the medieval thinkers, we see them judging the nations based on the seven Noahide laws. So that is the category, and we see that. Another way in which the Noahide laws come up or are related is this more to something more philosophical, is the question of how the other religions are to be judged in history, or why the nations exist at all, right? So we have, you know, and this takes us to a topic that will become much more developed in the modern period, but already we see hints of it in the medieval period. The Rambam discusses, well, first of all, he discusses the Christians and the Muslims in relation to the Noahide laws. He asks if they're idolaters, and he says the Christians are, but the Muslims are not. But then he has to deal with another question, is do the Muslims have a place in the world to come? And because there is an issue with this issue with Islam is not idolatry. The issue is the degree to which, from a Jewish perspective, the degree to which the Muslims accept the validity of the Torah, right? Classic Orthodox Islamic thinking, whether it's among the Sunnis or the Shias, is that the rabbis erred. They deformed the Torah, and Muhammad had to come to give the true teaching. So whereas they accept that the Torah was revealed to the Jewish people, they think that the Torah that the Jewish people now have and observe is deformed and incorrect. So they don't. And so the Rambam has a discussion. He lived at a time where there were Karaites. The Karaites did not accept the oral Torah. The Rambam has a discussion about, you know, those people who do not accept the Torah and whether they will have a place in the world to come. So he comes down pretty harshly on the Ishmaelites and in relation to that. But he has a somewhat less harsh perspective when he examines another question, sort of more philosophically, is like, what is the point? What is the point of the of Islam and Christianity? Because the Rambam, in his Laws of Kings and many of his writings, he is interested in defining the Messianic era. The Rambam, in his 13 principles, says, one of the things we should, of course, is await the coming of the Messiah. And so he's interested in what this era will look like. And he's clearly interested in the course of Jewish history, though he won't develop that in the same way that someone like Rav Kook will develop at a later point. And so he says that the Christians and the Muslims have played an important role in bringing the knowledge of God and the understanding of the Messiah to the nations of the world. So he sees them as part of God's plan. And this is, and he introduces an important element, and I think that it's an element that is sustained in among the rabbinic thinkers thinking about Christianity and Judaism, is that there is a certain ambivalence, both with regard to the Noahide laws and both with regard generally to Judaism, that Christianity, Islam can neither be completely condemned, nor can they be completely celebrated. Because on the one hand, they're bringing knowledge of one God to the world, and they certainly come close to the Noahide laws in many of their aspects and many of their teachings. On the other hand, there's the question of whether they are idolatrous and their relationship to the Torah, and of course their treatment of the Jews, because both of them do not accept the fact that they obfuscate their own source within Judaism, whether it's by saying that we have replaced the Jews as the Christians do or as the Muslims do as well. They say both of them in different ways say that they have replaced the Jews. So the Rambam introduces these important points. He defines these two religions in relation to the Noahide laws, and he discusses that they have a role to play in world history. And most of all, he reaffirms that there is a teaching for the world. That is to say that Judaism is not indifferent at all to how the world relates to each other, not just to the Jews, but to one another and to God. Right, this is a part of Jewish teaching. There are other later thinkers who will go into this, and I think the Rambam's sort of context of existing at a time where there is there's also a sort of interreligious strife, but there's interreligious contact, I think is very relevant. And we have another later thinker who goes into a sort of a different question, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, he asks, you know, the question of what the apostles were trying to do. He postulates that the apostles, when they sort of branched out from a kind of a Jewish sect, were in fact trying to teach the Noahide laws. This is what he sees is recorded in Acts, trying to teach the Noahide laws to the nations. But that this afterwards gets through the church fathers in various iterations, it gets distorted, is the right word. So there is an interest then in understanding what the relationship to the Noahide laws is to Christianity at this early phase. And of course, the rabbis know well that there is a group in the Talmud called the God-fearers, and that there is a period in Jewish history during the Roman and then Roman times where there was a considerable amount of interest in Judaism by people who did not formally complete the conversion process, right? Or did not get circumcised, but certainly believed in God. And so we're given this name of the God-fearers. And we have a source from the church fathers that attests to the widespread nature of this. One of the church fathers is called John Chrysostom. And John Chrysostom has a whole series of sermons called Contra Judeos, against the Jews. In these sources, he speaks to the Christians, telling them, do not get your fields blessed by the Jews, right? So these sort of mentions in the wayside suggest to us that the Jews had spiritual authority to many people, even who considered themselves Christians. And Chrysostom was among the church fathers who tried very much to develop Christian theology in a way that separated it from Judaism. So now we're getting, we're going through, for all that the Rambam, you know, talked about, you know, or at least provides us for a model of what the Messianic age might look like and what the future might look like, which includes the fact that the Jews will not only follow the Torah and the Talyag mitzvot, but that the nations of the world will follow the Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach. And there's a series of other medieval poskim who are interested in, you know, what is the ikar of the Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach? Are they really seven mitzvot? Are they seven legal categories? Are there other additional features? There are a number of medieval commentators who consider the nations to be bound by the law of kibud av ve'em, right? So there's a broader halachic discussion about these mitzvot sheva, but it remains a rabbinic discussion, which does not have any real practical application and does not have a particular echo among the nations until the 17th century. The 17th century is a time when the Rambam is translated into Latin. And it's a time right after the Reformation where we have a series of thinkers in England who, having gone through Oliver Cromwell and the Revolution, are interested in what is a crucial question for them, which is how to establish a functioning state that doesn't get embroiled in the laws of religion. And for various reasons, given the availability, and they are no longer tied to the church's interpretations, or not tied in the same way to the church's interpretations of the biblical text. They're informed enough by the Protestant movement, because they're already coming a century and a half after the Protestant movement, of what they call sola scriptura, only the Bible, that they're starting to look at the Bible with these kind of fresh eyes and relating to the Bible with the Bible's authority. And they're open to rabbinic interpretations of the Bible in a way that was not true in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, though there's the occasional cross-fertilization, we know that Rashi had some contacts with some priests of his time. The Christian thinkers are not only interested particularly in what the rabbis have to say about the Bible, they are hostile to the Talmud. We have the burnings of the Talmud, and they're hostile pretty much to the rabbinic tradition. And suddenly the 17th century, with these changes within Christianity, we have a group of legal thinkers, not priests, but legal thinkers who are interested in Jewish texts and who are interested in the Bible in a new way. There's also a whole way in which Newton's esoteric writings are look at the Bible and look at the Noahide laws. And I can't get into that for the moment. I'm going to look at the political background because I think this is the most impactful. So some of the major liberal British liberal thinkers who are also sort of the founders of here, we're all part of the Anglosphere, right? With all the differences between Australia, Canada, South Africa, the United States, they're all fundamentally heirs to the British political and legal tradition. And one of the most important figures in that is a man called John Selden. And so John Selden is one of the key people who picks up on the Rambam's thought in the Laws of Kings and his writings on the Noahide Laws. And he says, here's the solution to our problem of religious wars, which is that the state is given the authority by God to judge on these key moral questions, these key moral laws, and other matters of doctrine are matters that people can sort of choose freely. So he essentially creates a sort of doctrine of separation of church and state, while also maintaining that the state has a divinely ordained responsibility to maintain certain basic moral laws. So this is, a view that also corresponds to another idea that a number of these liberal thinkers, and Selden, though is not very well known today, was very influential on other thinkers that continue to be widely read in universities today, whether it's Hobbes or Hume, et cetera, the great sort of British liberal thinkers. And Selden's impact, the other aspect that was important was that these thinkers were looking at the Book of Deuteronomy as the so-called Hebrew Republic. That's how they wrote about it. And in fact, the scholar who did the most to bring this to the world's attention is a scholar at Harvard called Eric Nelson. And he wrote a book by that very name, The Hebrew Republic, which I highly recommend. It's a wonderful book. And he shows that in the 17th century, the mention of the Hebrew Republic was about as ubiquitous as critical race theory is in today's university. It was just everywhere. All of the great British thinkers were talking about the Hebrew Republic and the Book of Deuteronomy. And they were also discussing very much the way in which the question of royalty or kingship was discussed in the Book of Samuel, right? Samuel, Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, right? So here we have these British thinkers. So the Noahide laws have this impact on British and then later American political thought. But this impact is sort of forgotten even by the nations themselves, even by the American and British liberal tradition, because after the 18th and 19th century, the biblical source of modern liberalism ceases to be as important. And particularly 20th century scholars are, we're not invested in the biblical authority or the religious authority of laws in the way that their 17th century or 16th century forerunners were. So the Noahide laws is picked up by the Gentiles and has an impactful role because, after all, the United States and Britain become the great imperial powers of the 19th and 20th century. And American, British, if you will, Anglo political thought is one of the great political thought traditions of the modern world. So this is quite the impact indeed, but its source or its relationship to the Noahide laws is very poorly known. So after that time, and when the Noahide laws remain, we have Achronim who discussed the Noahide laws, and Rabbi Jacob Emden, as I just pointed out previously, is interested in thinking about whether how Christianity might have been a movement to extend the Noahide laws globally. There's another, I forgot to mention him, the Meiri in the medieval period is also interested in sort of questions about morality and the nations and ethics. And he comes up with sort of a somewhat different take on what makes, whether the nations are idolaters or righteous. He has a view that if they follow certain moral precepts, that's the most important thing. So there, it remains an eternal rabbinic discussion. There's one more rabbinic point I want to make that the Rambam discusses, and which has importance later on, is whether the nations are allowed, you know, that they have is a point of fact, but whether they're allowed, according to halacha, to create their own religions. Now, this may seem a strange question, but from the Jewish perspective, the nations have been through this oral tradition, they have been given the seven laws of Noah, and so that they are not to add to these laws in the same way that the Jews are not to add to the Torah, right? According to the Rambam. So the Rambam holds that it is asur, it is forbidden for the nations to create their own religions. This is also an important point to consider because it is not a point that all rabbinic authorities agree on. And certainly this is where the Meiri comes in, that he has a different perspective, that the nations of the world have them, if they follow various moral traditions, then they have their wisdoms and those have value. So we get now to the modern period. What is important to understand is that the rabbinic discussions exist sort of in two realities. They exist within the reality of how different rabbis understand the Torah and how different rabbis understand how different rabbis have themselves understood this inner discussion about what the Torah means, what the Torah is telling us that we should do or how we should see things. And then there's a discussion of the applicability in world circumstances. And in addition to that, the way that the world is sometimes raises new questions that had not, you know, that were not valid at a previous time, right? The questions the rabbis of the Mishnah are not interested in whether Christianity is Avodah Zarah or not, because Christianity is only, you know, a burgeoning movement. They get, or Islam doesn't exist at all. So they can't ask that question. So questions arise based on how the world is changing. And in the 19th century, what we have is we have an explosion, and this starts even earlier, of interreligious encounters, but also of a kind of universalism in philosophy as well, right? The Enlightenment is very interested. Christianity and Islam are not technically universal in the sense that Christianity, for example, at least the official doctrine of the church, the Catholic Church, is that if you're not baptized, you're in limbo, right? You're not, meaning that being born, that you have to become Christian really to have access to heaven and to be a fully good person. And Islam also, has a view that you have to accept the teachings of the prophet. So Islam and Christianity are universal in their aspirations, but there are people who they consider outside of Christianity, Islam, right? Whether it's idolaters or pagans, etc. It's not that the Enlightenment was somewhat different in that regard, in that the Enlightenment was interested in the rights and the obligations of all human beings, you know, irrespective of their religion and of their culture. So, and not to say that the Enlightenment didn't have, you know, every universal system has boundaries to the degree that it has any kind of ethics, because it means if you have an ethical system, someone is going to, you know, do something that is not ethical according to that system. But the Enlightenment certainly opened up this question of universality. And the question was also posed by the Christians themselves earlier. There's a very famous debate among various Spanish priests when the Spaniards conquered the Americas as to whether the Indians were human beings or not, right? Whether they could be, and this was not, this was not a sort of theoretical matter. This was a very practical matter because it had direct implications on how the Spaniards viewed whether they could enslave them or not, or how they could be treated or not. And those who adopted a more Aristotelian perspective thought that they could be enslaved, and those who adopted a more Christian perspective thought they could not be enslaved. So the question of the universal, much like the question of the Noahide laws, has direct political and business applications in the Christian world and in the Muslim world. Who do the Muslims consider to be idolaters? The idolaters must be converted to Islam, but the Muslims came up quite soon with a doctrine in relation to Jews and to Christians that they were a lesser form of monotheism, and they could be, it could remain in a kind of debased form within Muslim societies so long as they paid the jizya tax, etc. So the other monotheistic religions have a hierarchy, and they have an outgroup and an in-group, and they have a kind of lowest outgroup, which are the idolaters and the pagans, and then they have a kind of middling group. And the official Christian doctrine regarding the Jews is that they needed to persist to show that they had been abandoned by God, but that they did not have to be wiped out. That's the Augustinian doctrine. So the Jews are operating in a world where all of these different groups are coming to terms with people who are not like them. And the Enlightenment gets into other questions about rights in a universal sense, and starts considering, at least with the French Revolution and the philosophers, starts considering the question, whether of all humanity has certain rights or not. So it is in that context, in the Enlightenment context, and in the 19th century context, that we have something a little bit different coming from a rabbinic figure. We have a rabbi called Rabbi Eliyahu ben Amozeg. And he is based in Italy, in Livorno. He's born in 1822, and he is niftar, or he passes away in 1900. And at a time of a great intellectual ferment in Italy in the 19th century, so it's the early Enlightenment and then the late Enlightenment and the Romantic period. And he writes a series of books he's not simply writing Shelot and Tshuvot or writings in Hebrew but he's writing a text he writes in Italian and French as well. And he writes a book called Israel and Humanity. And in his book, in Israel and Humanity, what he does is he argues that really the Jewish people, all of humanity is made in God's image, something that I think is, as certainly various rabbinic commentators say, is the pshat of the text, although there are some rabbinic commentators who make a sharper distinction between the Jews and the nations. And that really, just as there are kohanim among the Jews are the kohanim for humanity. So humanity is united. We just have different roles. And the role of the Jews as the kohanim of humanity, the priestly nation, is to teach the Torah to humanity. And the Torah that they are to teach to humanity is the Torah of the seven Noahide laws. So he brings to the center, in terms of the Jewish people's divine mission, the Noahide laws, right? And it's not a great deviation from traditional rabbinic thought in a way. It's rather the novelty of it is that he's writing in a language that everybody can read. And he's expressly sort of bringing this back to the fore in a central way, whereas it had been peripheral in rabbinic writings, or at least the Shelot and Tshuvot of many of the rabbinic writings. I don't know if you can say it's peripheral to Maimonides. Maimonides deals with it in his Laws of Kings and in his other writings. But he really elevates this as one of the primary roles is to bring knowledge of God to the whole world. And how is that done? Through knowledge of the Noahide laws. And he also has, I think, he tends more to seeing Islam and Christianity as positive expressions of fulfillment of the Noahide laws, right? And he understands that there are negative aspects to Christianity and Islam, but he emphasizes those positive expressions. So that's kind of the beginning point. And there's a sort of a direct line between Eliyahu ben Amozeg and then what comes in the 20th and 21st century in a couple of different ways. So I will explore one of them first. We don't have that much time. Boy, it runs fast here. So I'll zip through this. So Eliyahu ben Amozeg had a student by the name of Aimé Pallière. And Aimé Pallière, he edited all of his writings. And Aimé Pallière wanted to convert to Judaism. He was a very pious man. And Eliyahu ben Amozeg said, no, don't convert, just become a Noahide. But Aimé Pallière was sort of this lone Noahide. And he ended up finding a place with himself where maintaining dialogue with various Christian priests and in some cases bishops and then later cardinals. as well as being the leader of the Reform Synagogue in Paris until his death in 1948. And Aimé Pallière is important because a number of the bishops and priests that he was in contact with became movers and shakers of Vatican II. Right, and Vatican II has a text which reevaluates how the church looks at Judaism. So this is kind of one vector, and this vector sort of shows where the Noahide laws are now operating in the 20th and the 21st century. And this is what I want to get to. Various different groups have picked up on the Noahide laws for different reasons in the 20s, I would say since the 1970s and 1980s. One group are often evangelical Christians, not always evangelicals. There are also in Europe groups that are formerly kind of mainline Protestant or Catholic who have visited Israel or who have read more deeply in the Jewish texts and remain committed to their belief in God and the authority of the Torah, but start to question aspects of Christian doctrine. And this led to the creation of Noahide communities. And there are a couple of Noahide communities in Europe and also now increasingly in West Africa. But these earlier communities were mainly Christians in the West and in Europe or in the United States. So we have them in Texas and Tennessee, et cetera. And they were communities that related directly to rabbis, and so they and established and sort of got onto a path of the Noahide laws as a kind of religion in the way that that Christianity was. And so various issues have come out of that. You know, what should the Noahides pray? What holidays should they celebrate? Right, because the Noahide laws are a series of prohibitions to create a moral society, and you know are arguably political. And here we have groups of people who no longer uphold some of the tenets of Christianity, are not necessarily interested in doing a full conversion to Judaism, and the initial at least halachic structure for them is the Noahide laws. But what about their religious observance? So here we have rabbinic thinkers who have kind of, many of them have attached themselves to certain rabbis I think it's correct to call modern Judaizing, which is that Judaizing, this is not a bad term. It's simply the term of people who are close to the Jewish people, who accept many principles of Judaism without fully belonging or doing a full conversion. And one could even argue that there are many people in Reform communities who haven't done a full Orthodox are sort of close to this whole movement. That is that there's an increasing interest on the part of the nations of the world to Judaism, and not all of them wish to do a full conversion, Orthodox conversion to Judaism. So, but what makes the Noahide communities, let's say, different than someone who is Jewish adjacent in liberal Jewish communities is the degree to which they accept the authority of the Torah. They see the Torah in the same way that Orthodox Jews would see the Torah, and the relationship they have usually with Orthodox rabbis. So there are a number, and that's one movement is really related to the Noahides themselves and the Noahide communities. Another movement is within the different branches of Orthodox Judaism, and that includes from the Haredi, to the most liberal modern Orthodox, and Dati Lumi, very Zionist, or what I would call more sort of YU, based in the United States, or in Chutz La'aretz, modern Orthodox. All of these different strands understand, or at least have within them individual rabbis who've expressed the necessity of developing the Noahide laws, right? We live in a time in globalization. We live in a time of interreligious encounter. And even though, for example, Rabbi Soloveitchik was against interreligious encounter theologically. He did not think there was any value in Jews and Christians talking to one another on theological matters. And this was the position, and in fact is the position of many Orthodox thinkers still. But what this group related to the No Hard Law says, well, we don't necessarily need to engage in interreligious dialogue, but we need to develop what Judaism says about the rest of the world. So the No Hard Laws intersect with the question of interreligious dialogue insofar as it's become related to the ways in which Orthodox people relate to interreligious dialogue that is different in the way that Reform or conservative Jews. There was a lot of interreligious dialogue by more liberal Reform and conservative congregations or figures like Martin Buber in the 20th century, and the Orthodox perspective was different than that. But there was a development, a questioning, and an additional aspect that has come out of this is how Jews relate to other great world religions, particularly Hinduism. So there are now recently a couple of books that have come out on that. There's a rabbi in Israel called Rabbi Alon Goshen Gottstein, who has created the Elijah Interfaith Center. So he's kind of at the intersection of interfaith dialogue and religious dialogue. He, I would say, is on the sort of most liberal end of orthodoxy, but he is certainly, he's musmach, he's a rabbi, and he wrote a book discussing whether Hinduism was of a avodah zara from a Jewish perspective, looking at all the relevant sources. And what distinguishes him and a number of orthodox scholars in the last 25 years is that he really knows Hinduism. Like he is because what has been difficult, and I want to give a sort of background that I think people who know Rav Kook will appreciate, is that in the 19th and 20th century, we have many, many Jews who are no longer religious, who are at the forefront of the study of anthropology, the study of other religions, etc., but who do not have Torah knowledge. So we have a situation that is in some ways analogous to the situation of politics that Rav Kook talks about, where we have many Jews interested in other religions, but who no longer know Torah. And then we have Jews who know Torah, but who don't know other religions. And so a lot of the question about the Noahide laws and had to bridge that gap of people who knew Torah and knew enough about the other religions. And this wasn't a problem so much with Christianity and Islam, although the degree to which people really knew Christianity and Islam, which have been undergoing very drastic changes in the last 500 years, varies. And then certainly not true about Hinduism. And I think about 15 or 20 years ago, there was a big uproar about the use of Indian hair and wigs, which brought to the fore this question of whether Hinduism was avodah zara or not by various. I think it was ruled by most of the poskim in the United States at that time that it was, and therefore that hair couldn't be used. But I think that there is room using shituf to take, I think, there is a range of, I think, legitimate perspectives, or at least on this question with regard to Hinduism. Another group of people who have been interested in the Noahide laws have been legal scholars. And legal scholars are interested in what is the authority or the basis of the law, right? And so we have at Cardozo School, a law school, but we also have in Israel with the Mishpat Ivri movement, someone called Nachum Rockover, who is interested in understanding how the Noahide laws relate to other legal theories, right? So what does that mean, relate to a legal theory? And what a legal theory says, the law is a law because, or the law is simply a contract between two groups, or the law is moral. Legal theory addresses the question of what is the nature of the law? So Nachum Rockover wrote a whole book simply on the question of dinim, on the last requirement to have a court system in the Noahide laws, and then we have a whole symposium by a scholar called Susan Stone at Cardozo Law School on the Noahide laws and their relationship to secular. There's another development that I haven't discussed that's of great importance, is Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson's interest in the Noahide laws. In addition, he was another important figure to bring this to the fore. He held, like the Rambam, that there was an obligation incumbent on the Jews to teach the Noahide laws. He did not think, and this was his view also in regards to the Jews, that you could enforce the death penalty with regard to Shabbat, for example, but rather that you had to teach them in the ways of pleasantness. And so the Lubavitch movement also was important in developing interest in the Noahide laws and in furthering. And the Lubavitch follows very closely the Rambam in that they feel that other religions, that the ideal for the nations of the world is sort of to leave their religion behind and just to kind of go into the Noahide laws. There's another perspective that comes from Rav Kook, which is that the objective of the Noahide laws, or the objective of the Jewish people in their relationship with the Gentiles, is to help them purify their own religions of what is idolatrous, much like how he felt that the Jewish people needed to purify Judaism of aspects of idolatry that had entered into it throughout the long exile. And so he is very much in line with Rabbi Eliyahu Ben Amozeg. Both of them are Kabbalists. Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson is also a Kabbalist, but I would say that if Chabad is more strongly on the Rambam side and less positively inclined to the other religions of the world, we have the camp of the groups that are more positively inclined to their religions, although all of them clearly against idolatry and clearly in favor of the Noahide laws, but we see that in the group of Rav Kook. And the people who are most bring this view to the fore is a rabbi called Rabbi Sherki, Rabbi Uri Sherki, who was a student at Merkaz of Rabbi Kook, Rav Kook Jr.'s son, and is also a student of a third figure who's important in this discussion and in the modern Noahide laws, is a figure called Rabbi Leon Ashkenazi, who was an Algerian Jew whose writings are mainly in French and in Hebrew, and who taught communities in Paris and then made Aliyah in the 1960s. And what Rabbi Ashkenazi brings to this, somewhat in line with Rav Kook, is a discussion of the archetypes of the different nations. And with this, I will, in the last 3 minutes that we have, I will finish. I haven't seen a single question. I don't know if this is whether you're riveted or perplexed, but is the question of let's call it the anthropology of the Bible, which is that the Rambam says, so what is the point of these different religions? And there's a bigger question is, what is the point of the nations? What is the point of human difference? Right? Why did God create a world where different cultures seem to have different knowledge about different things, but not only that, seem to have kind of tendencies towards creating different types of religions? And Rabbi Leon Ashkenazi is very well known in Israel to his students, and I recommend there's some material in English about him, in developing discussions about Esav and Ishmael as archetypes, and also other. In fact, the stories of Bereshit, Genesis, but also really Shemot, because Pharaoh, and the magician is a major figure in Parshat Shemot, is replete with Gentiles and replete with Gentiles who are in relationship to the Jewish people, right? So he is interested in what is the archetype of Esav and Esav's culture. So the discussion about the Noahide laws and Jewish universalism, therefore, touches on many topics that in the university world, we would say on legal theory, on anthropology, on philosophy, on ethics, right, on comparative religion. And it's being discussed by rabbinic figures and scholars in relation to those things. But it's an ongoing process. And so it's, I think, an exciting one that you can follow. Could you please address Buddhism? Very quickly, Rabbi Ashkenazi is known by his nickname Manitou. He was part of the Jewish Scout movement, and he got the name Manitou. And Manitou, by the way, has a Canadian relation. I want to speak about animism for a moment also, because I had the wonderful experience of meeting someone who's First Nations Cree from Manitoba in Israel. a man who had gone through the residential school system, had fled his residential school, lived on the street as an alcoholic for 15 years, cleaned up his act, gone to university, fell in love with Tanakh, likes the Jewish people, sees in Israel a rebirth, and came to Israel to describe that, and met me at the corner store in Tel Aviv. So, and why do I bring this up? Because there are many people among the so-called traditionally animist groups, that is, who were either Christianized or given or taught Islam, who have an appreciation for the Jewish people, and it's brought up the question, and who believe in the Creator. Most Native people that you talk about the Creator and the Creator said, etc. So there's the question of whether traditional Native American religions also qualify in relation to the Noahide laws. So Jewish adjacent are people who, like Judaism, like Jews, you know, kind of move in, maybe sort of hang out at a synagogue, whether it's a Reform or Orthodox or conservative or whatever, or interested in Jewish thought. So that's, you know, that's, and they may be married to Jews, or they may simply, you know, hang out with Jewish friends. That's sort of what Jewish adjacent is. And they may accept certain parts of Judaism and not others. For me, Jewish adjacent, though, it's, you know, there are many secular Jews who, you know, whose identity is not really related to Torah. So I'm talking about Jewish adjacent people who have a relationship to some aspect of Torah, or Jews who are related to some aspect of Torah. Lifnei iver, right? That's okay. So not putting a stumbling block before the blind, does that, that's one of the halachic questions that the Rishonim were interested in, right? Like there, if, you know, do you have to warn people of the mitzvot, of the seven Noahide laws? And it's that's like a longer question. I don't want to really get into it too much, but the seven Noahide laws are treated by the rabbis in the same way that they treat the Taryad mitzvot, which is that all the questions about halachic obligation exist there as well. I have a Christian friend who are pro Torah and a Native American, Riverwinds. Yes, I know the Riverwinds. I have some dealings with Native American indigenous issues. I don't know them personally, but I know of them. An aide we hired to help a sick relative said she would pray to her God of health to heal her sick relative. How does one reply to that? Well, okay. First let me get to the Buddhists. And so what religion is your aide? Cause that's the question. Whoever asked that question, please answer me on that. In relation to Buddhism, so Buddhism is
relationship. I'm sorry.
The person who asked a question about that they would pray to her God of health to heal our sick, are they Hindu?
I didn't know. I didn't know exactly what the religion was. I was just taken back, because she seemed to speak of a deity as being one of many deities.
Right. So, I would suspect that is someone who's Hindu. They're not, it may be Jain. Most of the world today is divided up in either some of the older animistic religions, or they're one of the Indian religions, or they're, or they're Muslim or they're Christian. Buddhism is really an offshoot of Hinduism, and Buddhism is complicated in the sense that it's not clear whether they have a concept of God or not. Jew-Boos are really interested in Buddhist practices and Buddhist ethics, and I think if they're atheists, are usually attracted to the lack of theism in Buddhism. This brings in a deeper question which relates to Rav Kook, which is, Rav Kook says, when he talks about politics, he says, whenever you see a bunch of Jews flock to something, whether it's an ideology, it means that there's some kind of spark in what they're doing. If lots of Jews are interested in communism, there's got to be a spark there. If lots of Jews are interested in nationalism, there's something that the contemporary Torah authorities are not dealing with adequately, that Jews who are motivated by their Jewish soul are running to find in a foreign ideology. And we find that there are many, many Jews, particularly from Israel, but also Jews in the diaspora, who are drawn to the Eastern religions, right, who are drawn to going to India, who are drawn to Buddhism. And so for many people who are involved in the Noahide laws or Jewish universalism, they're saying, so on the one hand, this is part of this dialogue that these particular nations and religions have a certain midot or certain characteristics that are part of Torah, but that we have lost, but that there's something that we can learn from them in relation. And so many, the Jew movement has sparked a whole renewal of Jewish meditation practices, which have existed, but just were certainly peripheral to mainstream Jewish practice for a long time. And the same thing with Hinduism, the kind of aspects of gratitude and sort of openness and spirituality, which many Israelis find among the Hindus, have inspired a desire to find that within Torah itself. Let's see. In Hawaii, we encountered a private sect who were like non-Jewish Karaites. They knew a lot about how we understand mitzvot. Okay, so one of... I want to get to another issue is that most of the world has been, say, Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians included, most of the animist peoples of the world have been in some kind of relationship with Islamic or Christian colonization, right? So Indonesia is the largest. Indonesia got Islamified quite late in the 15th century. It's the largest Muslim country in the world outside all of, you know, all of the, and then all of the Americas. So today, most native peoples in Canada, for example, or across the Americas, let's take the Maori, for example. Maori spirituality has already lost some of the aspects that are kind of untoward. You know, there are some aspects of Maori culture which were pretty hardcore, like cannibalism is a practice among warriors with it. And there's also various other aspects that Maoris today have kind of pushed to the side. And there's reason to think that this has to do with the general movement of culture, whether it's the Christianity encountered with the colonizers, or whether it's kind of the general move towards human rights in international culture that has made these traditional aspects of Maori culture frowned upon even among Maoris themselves. So there's been a kind of, to use Rav Cook's language, a kind of cleaning out of religions through this historical process of both secularism and the spread of Christianity and Islam. And in a way, it makes it easier to relate to the Noahide laws. And so with this group in Hawaii, to get back to your question, many Native people or formerly animist people have a positive relationship to Torah and Judaism and have some kind of Judaizing practices, which they combine with their traditional spirituality. So let's see. Any more questions? Do you have a concept in the traditional halacha that there may be many paths to God and that we should impose our practice on ancient cultures that had exposure? Yes. So this is from Morris Sosnovich. So this is, I think that the Noahide law is the idea of many paths to God. It speaks to this question of why God created the nations and their differences. And I think that whereas the Rambam and maybe Chabad is more focused on what the nations should not do, which is idolatrous, and what the Jews also should not do, everyone, that there are other thinkers, and everyone's concerned with that. Nobody wants people to do idolatry. There are other thinkers who are more interested in saying, okay, we have this world where people have different approaches, right, who've developed these cultures. Is there something of value in that? And I think that is the approach of the people who follow the Meiri and the people who follow Rav Cook, who are saying, we need to cleanse all of these things from idolatry, but there is something to be learned from all of the different cultures. There's something to be learned from the wisdom of all of the nations, and including that, and some would go even further, including how they approach God, that has to do with their midot. And there's all kinds of Kabbalistic calculations about this, right? There are 72 archetypal nations. This relates to the Sfirot. It relates also in the Hanukkiah, right, to the eight the 8 days of Hanukkah, which are the seven wisdoms and the Torah, and that these are all one, and the 70 nations with their different mitzvot. Someone, I don't know if it's ironically, but someone who has written about this is Rabbi Yitzchak Ginsburg. And many people can say, Rabbi Yitzchak Ginsburg is very hardcore Chabad, and he is, but he also writes about Kabbalah, and he's written two books related to, Kabbalah and the nations and Torah and the nations. So, where he theorizes on the different midot as they relate to kind of the different kind of big national and cultural groups. So different, all of the differences that we find among the types of orthodoxy are expressed in how they relate to the Noahide laws. There are many yeshivish. There's a rabbi called Rabbi Yoel Schwartz who lives in Mea Sharim and who was definitely Haredi and who has written extensively about the Noahide laws. So it is present and each community is interested in the things that characterize that community. So the Rav Kooknicks who are interested when it comes to Judaism in questions about politics in the contemporary world are interested in those things when it comes to the Noahide laws of the nations. And Chabad that is interested in getting people to do the right mitzvot to bring Mashiach now are interested in getting the Noahide laws with stickers to know in getting as many people as possible to know the Noahide laws. And I'm not God forbid that I should say that. I'm not saying that in jest. I'm just saying that there is a coherence in the halachic approach to the Torah and Mitzvot and the Noahide laws. I'm now 11 minutes over time. A bunch of people. I don't know if how long do we want to go here?
Another minute or two. That's it. No, I mean okay. People. No one is forced to stay, but yes, I would wrap up.
My husband is. I have two small children. I have a toddler and a baby. So we're coming now. Back in 3 minutes. So I will say that this is a very exciting part of Torah right now that is being brought to the fore and developed. I will give you a few places to look. You can look. There's plenty of websites. Aaron, I have my bibliography here. I was going through WorldCat recently. WorldCat is this big library website. Just put in Noahide laws of all the different thinkers. So a few people to keep in mind, a classic book written in the 90s, academic, but someone from YU. So a few classic people who deserve credit. David Novak, who was at the University of Toronto for a long time, wrote a classic book on the Noahide laws. He deserves a lot of credit for bringing them back. And he also has worked very extensively on looking at the Noahide laws in terms of general morality in the public sphere. So he's a traditionalist Jew. I don't know if he would call himself Orthodox, maybe not, but he's, Ian, there's another person who deserves credit is a rabbi called Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who I don't know if he's still alive, but he wrote a classic book in 1995 on the Noahide laws. There are other rabbi, and also Nachum Rackover. These are if you want to read the Gentile appreciation of the Noahide laws, I suggest you read Eric Nelson's The Hebrew Republic. And then in terms of other really rabbis who are very focused on this, Rabbi Uri Sherki, he has an organization called Brit Olam. I'm actually writing a book for them on the Noahide laws. So Brit Olam, you can look them up. They have stuff in English, I believe, also. There's another, there's a Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition by David Sears. David Sears represents the Neo-Hasidic approach. That's another good book that has a lot of good sources. Even Breslov has a Universal Garden of Emunah. So if you like, meaning they published a Garden of Emunah, which was about 10, 15 years ago, was a very, so there's even children's books on the Noahide laws, and there's also Sephardic thinking on the Noahide laws. The Noahide laws, of course, with Rabbi Ben Amozeg, but there's a whole world of Sephardic thought, Kabbalistic thought, Leon Ashkenazi kind of going through Europe in this case, but there are other writings. We have Michael Shlomo Bar-Ron, who wrote Guide for the Noahide, who's coming out of this Sephardic tradition. So we have books that are guides for the Noahide. We have a Noahide prayer book, so we have material. And then we have these larger questions that we have to answer in this very exciting time of our history, where we are blessed to be able to learn Torah in relative freedom and to deal with these major questions. So I want to end with a tefillah that we should all have bizocha to continue in our Torah growth in whatever path Hashem wants for us, and I guess to enjoy the lights of the geula. It should come speedily in our day. And thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. A pleasure. I think as ones you just wrote, you know, open up a sort of a new area of thinking, and for the historical overview of this important and subject that we, of course, don't often pay too much attention to, at least most of us. So thank you. And we'll let you go take care of the kids. More important. Okay.
From, take care. Good night. Good
thank
night,
you.
Everyone.
From the religious to this, the sociological, tomorrow at 11 o'clock, Mark Trencher will be giving part one of a two-part series. He's the runs, you know, Nishma. I'm sure many of you saw last week they came out with the survey of the finances of the Orthodox world. He runs these basically studies like quote unquote, like on the Pew Report, but focusing on the Orthodox community. So he'll be giving a two-part series tomorrow, generally the state of modern Orthodoxy, whatever that means. That's part of what he'll discuss. And then next week, he'll discuss the finances of modern Orthodoxy. So between then and now, Dr. Sokolow will give his regular class on the putting together of Tanakh. That's this evening at 8 o'clock. Please join us and invite your friends. I do want to make mention for those who are still here, and that's about half of you. From the beginning, in our winter series, just two classes that are going to, we haven't publicized it yet, but I'll let you know two of the classes we're doing is Menachem Kellner is going to be giving a three-part series on Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rambam. There are different attitudes towards Jews and non-Jews, you know, on this topic. He's, of course, a prominent professor, big expert on the Rambam living in Israel. So that'll be starting in February, actually. And Dr. Lindsay Guhartz, who just gave this seven-part series on translation, is going to give a longer series on Islam, what Jews should know about Islam, a whole, so I don't know, it sounds interesting. So that will be starting in a couple of weeks. Of course, look your emails. The details will be coming out shortly. Okay. A pleasure learning with everybody. We hope to see you this evening, tomorrow, and then tomorrow night, Parsha, Friday morning, my class on the Siddur. And everybody have a wonderful day and, be well, be safe, and invite your friends to come and learn. And, it should be, a good year. What I say as we come to the end of the year, you know, we can say, that's what we say before Rosh Hashanah. But we can say that here for the klala of the, of COVID should come to an end as the year comes to an end, then we should have good, wonderful things to continue. Okay, everybody be well. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.